Welcome to Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio with author, speaker, and your host, Pat Rulo, serving you a generous helping of everything you need to know to help you and your loved ones stay safe during any doctor or hospital visit. The program is not intended to replace medical advice from a licensed professional, but rather to encourage you to become a well-informed participant in your health and well-being. And now, your host, Pat Rulo.
So I often argue there's a war on between clinicians and patients. Mm-hmm. Patients are, if we could just get them out of the way, healthcare would be wonderful. And poor patients are victimized, not intentionally, but because no one ever thinks about these things and challenges these roles we've all been socialized to play for the last 100 years.
Hello, I'm Pat Rulo. Welcome to another great hour together. A time where we think about our health, the health of our loved ones, and that includes our pets, or in my case, animals who hang around my house looking for a little love and a lot of food. You know, we talk a lot on this program about being an advocate for ourselves and often for others, our family and friends. But who advocates for little innocent animal creatures? I've mentioned before that I adopted a little feral cat last year whose mom, whom we now call Mother, left her out on our deck because she was pregnant with another litter and didn't seem interested to care for her little striped baby. Never having been a cat person, and actually severely allergic for my entire life, I came to care for this little girl, we call her Stripey. I fed her outside, played in the leaves with her, and as last winter approached, I just couldn't imagine leaving her alone outside to fend for herself in the freezing cold. And as if by magic, my cat allergy disappeared. No itching, no sneezing, wheezing, rashing, gone. Well, long story short, Mother has gone on to have 3 more litters, as she is impossible to catch to get her to the local rescue shelter for their trap, neuter, and return program. One litter died, and the last 2 survived. So now we feed 10 cats on the deck. Obviously, I cannot bring them all in this winter, lest I become that crazy cat lady. So Bob built this really cool shelter within our garage. Problem is, the 7-month-old cats are not allowed in to keep warm with the 7-week-old cats, thanks to Mother. Yep, the same Mother. Well, now, as you can imagine, feeding this crowd is getting quite expensive, as I've chosen not to feed them the typical Purina-type grain cat food, because I thought, cats eat meat in the wild, not corn. So to best accommodate their gastronomic preferences, oh yeah, we're buying chicken thighs and warming them to a nice mouse temperature. I know, sucker, right? Yeah. Well, now, all of these cats, I guess, would be considered feral cats, as they are not someone's cat who got lost. Feral cats are the same species as pet cats. But feral cats, also called community or outdoor cats, live in groups called colonies and can thrive in every landscape. They are just as healthy as pet cats, but they are not socialized to humans and therefore are considered unadoptable. Mother was born to a feral, and if it weren't for the fact that they've been socialized at a young age, the whole crowd would be wild. But through trap, neuter, return, a humane approach to managing and caring for community cats, which actually is the only effective method of stabilizing cat colonies. In the last decade, the number of local governments with official policies that endorse the trap, neuter, return has increased tenfold, with hundreds of cities and towns successfully carrying out the TNR, trap, neuter, return programs. However, in a majority of cities, cats are still caught and brought to animal pounds and shelters where they are killed. Now, many shelter systems don't kill the cats, but often many do. The shelter system is the number one cause of death for cats in the United States. About 70% of cats who enter shelters are killed there, including virtually 100% of feral cats. Poor little things. So I bring this up for several reasons. One is that as humans, we have to advocate for little animals who need food, shelter, protection, and love. Secondly, it's National Feral Cat Awareness Day, a day to bring attention to the unnecessary killing of cats in animal control pounds and shelters. Again, as I mentioned, the leading documented cause of death for cats in the United States. A day to help change society and create compassionate communities for cats and awareness to the trap, neuter, return programs. If you have community cats around your home, give some thought to their plight this coming winter. It's really easy to build some small shelters out of Rubbermaid roughneck containers, some white foam insulation, and duct tape. I did this last year before I decided to go big time. And actually, if you purchase the few supplies to make them and don't know how or don't have the time or energy, you can drop off the supplies to me and Bob, and we'll make them for you at no charge. There's more information about that at the website, speakupandstayalive.com. Speakupandstayalive.com, and visit the post that says Feral Cat Day Project. Or you can call me, 440-725-5462. That's 440-725-5462. Be an advocate for another life, a tiny creature that cannot advocate for him or herself. It feels good to make a friend, and I've been blessed to have made 11 new friends, and it doesn't get any better than that. Well, now, enough about cats. It's time to head into the patient safety portion of the show. I have a guest coming up who has quite a bit of expertise when it comes to the communication gap between patients and doctors, and I know you'll enjoy him. But before that, you know what time it is. It's time for the hospital hazard of the week.
I'm in.
You're out.
I'm in.
I'm out.
I'm out. You're in.
I'm in too.
Are you in or are you out? Here's the scene. You come into the emergency room on a Monday evening. Now it's 7 p.m. the next day and you're in a hospital room, lying in a hospital bed. You've seen doctors and nurses. You've had medications and treatments. So you're officially an admitted hospital inpatient, right? Maybe not. Instead, you may be considered an outpatient. A hospital may classify an overnight hospital stay in one of two ways, either as an admission, which means inpatient, or under observation, which means you're an outpatient. Now, you may be receiving the same care, but depending on your classification, inpatient or observation, Medicare pays the provider differently. Sounds like a recipe for trouble, wouldn't you say? Yet, interestingly, over the last several years, the number of patients placed in observation status has grown, increasing the challenges faced by hospitals and patients. Since 2006, so-called observation claims submitted to Medicare for payment have gone up by over 50% as providers and hospitals watch their financial back and struggle with interpreting or misinterpreting the rules, risking penalties, fines, or simply non-payment. So what's the difference between inpatient and observation? According to the Center for Health Affairs Policy Snapshot, when a patient arrives at the hospital emergency room, healthcare professionals make their best judgment about the most appropriate setting in which to provide care. Some patients will be treated in the emergency department and then discharged. Others will be seen in the emergency department and then admitted as an inpatient. And others will be placed in observation status. While it's easy to understand the status of the emergency room and inpatient, there's been some confusion about what observation status means. Observation status. It was created by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the federal agency that administers those programs. So the Centers for Medicare Services established this designation to enable hospitals to provide ongoing short-term treatment, assessment, and reassessment before a decision can be made regarding whether the patients will need further treatment as hospital patients or if they're able to be discharged from the hospital. Observation status, which is an outpatient designation, allows doctors to watch a patient for a short time in the hospital, usually 24 to 48 hours, and then to make a decision about whether or not to admit. While observation status is most commonly used after a patient arrives at the hospital emergency room, It can also be used in other circumstances. For example, a patient who has just had surgery may enter observation status if they were supposed to go home but were unable to recover fully within the surgical recovery time frame. Now, as a patient, how would you know if you were classed as an inpatient or under observation? I mean, after all, you're sick or hurt and not capable of deciphering the mumbo-jumbo. Yet, not knowing can have significant financial implications. Medicare's under observation or outpatient visits are subject to different and sometimes higher copayments, deductibles, and coinsurance than the admitted patient's copayments. Now, here's where it really gets dangerous. Your greatest financial liability might end up being your post-hospital care once you're discharged from the hospital. For patients who require skilled nursing care after an observation stay for services such as physical therapy or wound care or medication administration, none of that would be covered under Medicare unless you were in the hospital as an inpatient for a period of at least 3 midnights. Medicare will only cover the cost of skilled nursing care if it is preceded by a 3-day hospital inpatient stay, and that is extremely important for you to know and to remember. Under the current policy, an observation time cannot be counted toward that 3-midnight requirement. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has tried to clarify this situation by issuing a rule stating that if a doctor expects a patient's hospital care to last more than 2 midnights, then the patient should be admitted as an inpatient. Otherwise, observation status applies and the outpatient benefits apply. The clock starts ticking once you have arrived in a treatment area such as the emergency room. Time spent in the waiting room does not apply toward the magical midnight clock game. Being an inpatient means that your Medicare Part A benefits apply. Being under observation means Parts B and D apply. And depending on what other kind of insurance you have, you might have more copays with an observation stay than an inpatient stay because tests, treatments, medications, and so on are billed separately. So once again, we're back to the title of this program, Speak Up and Stay Alive. In other words, if you find yourself in a hospital bed, ask right away, am I in or am I out? Am I under observation or am I considered an admitted inpatient? In most instances, hospitals are not required to notify you if you are under observation. Sadly, it's just one more thing you have to think about and to ask about if you are hospitalized. And if you know that you're on observation status and might be facing a skilled nursing home stay, call your primary care doctor and bring him or her into the ring. He or she may have some pivotal information about your health that didn't make it into your hospital record, and we know that that happens. And you can also speak to the hospital case managers, patient advocates, or other hospital administrative staff. These ill-conceived payment policies created by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid hinder doctors' efforts to provide the highest quality of care to patients, as now they're forced to make business decisions and legal decisions that have little to do with patient care. And at the same time, unfairly sidestep the important aspect of communicating with the patient and further burdening patients with excessive bills. Once again, folks, it's up to us, our family members, and whomever it is that acts as our patient advocate to know about this, to remember it, and to ask about it right up front prior to any hospital stay. You might survive the visit, but you could be devastated financially after the fact. And this makes me want to remind you that if you've been in this situation and have bills for non-coverage, you can appeal that decision. There are folks out there to help you. Don't just pay the bill, get some help. Bottom line, as usual, speak up. It's too bad that all of this tricky stuff goes on in the background, but now you know. And be sure to share this with your friends and family. I'll post an audio of this on the website, speakupandstayalive.com. So you can hear it again, or as a place to send others to listen. So, are you in or are you out? Be sure to ask. Remember, you have to speak up and stay alive.
I'm in.
You're out.
I'm in.
I'm out.
I'm out. You're in.
I'm in too. I'm under observation.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.
Pharmaceutical industry is wreaking havoc on our health. Drugs promoted on TV and magazines. Drugs, drugs, drugs. I'm Pat Rulo, radio host of Speak Up and Stay Alive Patient Safety Radio, with a new line of essential oils called Tiny Drops. Essential oils are powerful and concentrated plant essences. And just one tiny drop can have noticeable health benefits. No pills and no nasty side effects. Take charge of your health. Tiny Drops, big results. Visit tinydropseo.com. You're listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive Patient Safety Radio, and I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. Always searching for answers to share with you that will improve your patient experience and ultimately keep you safe during every healthcare or hospital encounter. Now, you might remember several weeks ago I did a segment on hospital codes, and I shared a blog post written by a former hospital executive that asked the question, why can't we call a bad experience code just like hospitals call codes over the PA system? Hospitals have a code gray to alert staff of an unruly patient. Why can't patients have a code to call on disrespectful or angry staff or physician behavior? And I promised I would invite the author of this fine piece to share his wisdom with us today. Well, he is here today. My special guest is Stephen Wilkins, principal and founder of Mind the Gap Academy, a consulting, training, and solutions company focusing on improving physician-patient communications and engagement with the goal of improving patient outcomes, enhancing quality and satisfaction while reducing costs. But here today, we are talking about the gap between patient and physician. And we talk about that communication gap quite often on this program. So I'm especially excited and interested to engage today's guest. So welcome to the show, Steve.
Well, thank you very much, Pat. I appreciate it. Great introduction.
Yay, thank you. I was so excited to have you on today. And your blog posts on Mind the Gap Academy are just outstanding. I mean, you hit the nail on the head with every post, so I'm going to encourage our listeners to head over there. I so feel in alignment with what you're saying. Now, we hear a lot about patient engagement, how providers must engage their patients, and I kind of have a sinking feeling that what that means to the provider and what it means to the patient are often two different meanings and processes.
Absolutely. Let's start with the physician. Physicians tend to define engagement as a patient who does what they're told. Mm-hmm. So physicians tend to equate engagement with compliance. Their definition of engagement and their measure of engagement is whether they feel patients are doing what they're told. So that if you are a non-adherent patient, let's say an intentionally non-adherent patient, your doctor prescribes medication to you and you go home and you simply say, I'm not going to fill that prescription because I don't think I need it. Most people are not going to have that discussion with their doctor. They're just going to go home and not fill the prescription, be intentionally not adherent. The doctor interprets that as being an unengaged patient. The patient, on the other hand, looks at that and thinks, the question of engagement never comes up physically in the exam room. The patient thinks about that, this is the best decision for me. I'm not going to get engaged. And since my doctor didn't ask for my opinion, I couldn't get it, I'm not going to argue with him, I'm just not going to fill the prescription. Engagement is about being cognitively and emotionally involved in your health. And I would posit that the very act of going to the doctor is an amazing sign of engagement, meaning that before you go to the doctor, you as an individual sitting at home, you might talk to your friends or family about your signs, concerns, or symptoms, but you go through and make a decision. And you may share the decision with your spouse or friends. You then pick up the phone and make an appointment if you came to the conclusion that a visit was necessary. You then wait for the appointment. Then you take time off of work or out of your busy life and you show up for the appointment. Then you sit in the waiting room, and as you're sitting there, most of us think about, well, what am I going to talk to the doctor about? What do I want to accomplish during this visit today? So you kind of make a mental list of questions. And then you show up in the exam room. And as soon as you walk through the exam room doors, when people become patients, meaning many of us check our brains at the door, mm-hmm. walk into the exam room, sit in the exam room table, and all of a sudden we're a patient. And in the course of entering the exam room, we assume a new role as patient, and that patient role is opposite the physician's role. Physician's role is that an expert in charge does most of the talking, asks most of the questions, makes most, if not all, the decisions. And the patient's role is to be passive and compliant. So patients are engaged, meaning cognitively and emotionally involved in their health up to the point that walking in the exam room. But what then all in the exam room, all bets are off.
Mm-hmm.
That they don't ask many questions. They certainly don't challenge the doctor. And I'm talking about generalities here. There's always the outlier. And they tell doctors what they want to hear because nobody wants to be perceived as a bad patient. So the opposite of a bad patient is a good patient. A good patient is someone that we've all figured out years ago over the course of going to doctors. A good patient is somebody that does what the doctor tells them to do. We sit there, smile, shake our head. We don't want to be perceived as difficult patients, somebody whom our doctor may want to fire because we're difficult. That's the juxtaposition of patient engagement from the physician's perspective, i.e. compliance. The patient's perspective is passivity. All the focus today is on patient portals and high tech, and communicate, and that's defined as engagement, meaningful use. I think that's framing engagement in an incorrect fashion. I think that before you can engage people online on a patient portal or open notes mechanism, the patient needs to feel that the doctor's engaging in a face-to-face situation.
Right, right. Have a real relationship with that person.
That you can ask a question, that the doctor listens to you and understands you as a person, doesn't seem rushed, asks your opinion. Before they put you on hospice, for example,
mm-hmm.
case with my wife, they in fact ask you what you think is the patient.
Yeah.
And instead of just referring you to hospice without even offering that as an option.
Exactly, as if you're not even there.
Yeah, and as if they know best.
Mm-hmm.
And that the assumptions that they have are more valid than your life's experience as a patient.
Right.
And so patients, I often argue there's a war on between clinicians and patients.
Mm-hmm.
Patients are, we could just get them out of the way, healthcare would be wonderful. And poor patients are victimized, not intentionally, but because no one ever thinks about these things and challenges these roles we've all been socialized to play for the last 100 years.
As you said, we already are engaged just by the fact that we showed up, but maybe we can actually, as a patient, guide that process a little more, just in the fact that we could realize that we have that power.
Well, Pat, you're absolutely right. The patient, believe it or not, in the research, has a lot of control over what potentially is said and how the conversation goes.
Right.
And that physicians come in and they not only evaluate patients clinically, they also evaluate their quote-unquote health capital as people. Are they verbal? Can they put a coherent sentence together, mm-hmm. or do they ramble? And most of the time they're disappointed and they just say, it's not worth trying to... I wasn't trained to get to know patients. I was trained to diagnose and treat disease. And in fact, that's an interesting point that most doctors will tell you. I was never taught the value of getting to know the person behind the patient label. I was never taught to engage patients. There's no purpose, because the only reason we were taught to talk to patients is to arrive at a diagnosis.
Right.
And once you arrive at a diagnosis, there's no point in talking to the patient. And doctors will tell you that. So that's the old physician-directed, disease-focused communications approach. The patient-centered approach, which is really, I think, at the heart of what we're talking about here, is getting the patient's perspective in addition to the provider's perspective.
Exactly, exactly. It's a partnership.
And not giving the patient everything they want, because that's what most physicians are afraid of, but at least asking the patients their perspective of what's wrong with them and what they want to see done.
To me, there's a lot of diagnostic value in actually looking at the patient, watching just their body language, in addition to hearing what they have to say, because the patient knows themselves the best. And I really think a lot is missed when the physician either doesn't look, doesn't ask, and just kind of goes on to their own
agenda. Oh, no, you're absolutely right. I don't know if you're familiar with Abraham Verghese, doctor, physician at Stanford. But he talks eloquently and passionately about how we're we're now moving to the era of a 3D virtual patient, mm-hmm. 2D virtual patient, meaning that all the clinicians are now off, not at the bedside, but are off in some room, standing around a computer, looking at the digital equivalent of the patient that's created in this computer.
Wow.
The patient's sitting in their room asking, where's all the people?
Yeah.
You know, nobody touches the patient anymore, mm-hmm. touches therapeutic. Nobody comes in and talks to the patient to any great extent. Talk is therapeutic. Yeah. And so the patient is kind of left out of the equation. And the same thing is true to some extent in the exam room, where now the medical records, electronic medical records, is kind of interposed between the patient and the physician. And eye contact and whatnot is focused more on the laptop.
Yep.
The patient.
Yeah.
And so you're right. I mean, we're becoming more digital and less human in the way healthcare is delivered. And there's going to be a price to pay for that. There already is. But there's going to be a bigger price to pay as people become more disaffected, more non-adherent, and dissatisfaction scores go down. But your point about communications and diagnostic value is right on the money. There is something I learned early on that most doctors will also tell you, that they can come in and size up a patient within 10 seconds, mm-hmm. looking at them without even talking to them.
Wow.
And when they talk to them, they can learn a little bit more. And so they arrive at a working diagnosis, differential diagnosis, and in many cases they never question that. By talking to the patient, actually asking the patient what they think is wrong and or their expectations of what they want to get out of the visit.
Mm-hmm.
Communications is essential to improving diagnostic accuracy, which in turn then drives the efficacy of treatment.
Right.
If the diagnosis is inaccurate, then the treatment and outcomes are going to be inaccurate.
You mentioned patient satisfaction, and I want to read a little quote that I read from one of your blog entries. And you say, often patients are, in fact, overly patient. They put up with unnecessary discomforts and grant their doctors the benefit of every doubt until deficiencies in care are too manifest to be overlooked. Generally speaking, one can assume that the quality of care is, actually, worse than surveys of patient satisfaction would seem to show. Patients need to be taught to be less patient, more critical, and more assertive. And so I'm wondering, with that statement, patient satisfaction surveys, are they working to create a safer patient experience, or are patients, as you say, too patient, even when it comes to sharing their feelings on those surveys?
I'm perplexed at how any institution, not to mention individual provider, can take those findings and do anything with
mm-hmm.
them. Because they're so general, the questions are worded in a very general and vague way, and oftentimes they're administered any time 6 weeks to 6 months after the episode of care that they're asking
mm-hmm.
about. Because usually the questions are, in the last 12 months, have you experienced blah, blah, blah. And so you're asking people to remember a lot. Typically, experiences are created by personal interactions with other people. You could have a terrible interaction with 3/4 of the people in the hospital, and all of a sudden you meet one person who makes a big difference in your experience. My inclination is that all of a sudden you're going to give that hospital a good rating, simply because of that one person. Because that's what you remember, and that's what stuck out. Even though prior to meeting that one person, you thought 3/4 of the rest of the people weren't very friendly. So I don't know how useful those satisfaction scores are. In terms of safety, I for the life of me, I can't figure out how in any way, shape, or form that they impact safety.
Right.
It's a marketing tool,
mm-hmm.
and now it's a reimbursement tool.
Yes.
People just take a line and mark them all down, very good.
Right.
Or poor.
Right.
They don't give much thought to that.
Yeah.
So I think patient satisfaction questionnaires, as they're done now, are more like beauty pageants, kind of a beauty cosmetic
mm-hmm.
contest rather than an effective measure of what's really, really going on and what's really important to patients.
But too bad. I mean, the hospitals are kind of forced to use that because part of their compensation is tied to that. So they're not going to try to see past that because they're getting paid or getting not paid because of the results.
Oh, no, that's exactly right. They tune me out when I talk about this.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk briefly about expectations, because I've always maintained that patient expectations have a great deal to do with a patient's satisfaction, and yet expectations are based on previous experiences, the person's education, culture, and so many other things that actually may be unrealistic for the hospital to actually satisfy. What do you think can be done at the hospital level to better prepare patients so that patient expectations align with reality?
Just because patients have expectations doesn't mean they need to be met,
right,
in order to get high satisfaction scores. So the classic example in the exam room, and again, this applies to hospitals, is that physicians always tell you about the patient that comes in and wants a CAT scan because they have a headache. And so my friend got a CAT scan, I want a CAT scan. Well, doctors interpret that as being one of the problems of patient-centered care, that patient-centered care means giving the patient what they ask for. Well, it doesn't. What it does, though, it creates is an opportunity, an engagement opportunity for the physician to help find out why the patient feels they need the CAT scan, and then explain to the patient why they don't. They never teach the patient anything. They never explain to the patient. Once a physician learns of an expectation, they can either fill it, postpone it, or explain to the patient why it's not appropriate for them, and here's the alternative.
Excellent, yeah.
And most of the time, then, they walk away satisfied, even though you didn't give them what they asked for. You don't have to give people what they ask for in order to satisfy them. You have to treat them intelligently in order to get them to be satisfied.
Right, so it all circles back to communication.
Yeah.
Wow. I know there's so much more. I wanted to talk about technology and all kinds of things, but only so much time. So where can we go then to learn about you and your work? I want to send our listeners off to find out more about you.
Best place to start would be Mind the Gap Academy.
That's mindthegapacademy.com. Well, I think everyone agrees that to improve patient engagement, to allow for safer patient experiences and outcomes, we must give thought and action to better physician-patient communication. And Steve, I think you are the man to do it.
I appreciate that, but I appreciate the work that you're doing, because it's folks like you that also help patients, that empower patients, teach them what they need. So kudos to you and your listeners.
Well, I appreciate that. It's been a pleasure to engage with you today, and you are welcome here anytime.
Hey, I have a lot to say.
We have a lot to ask. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Did you know that over 70 hospitals nationwide are using essential oils to fight germs, improve mood, and reduce stress? I'm Pat Rulo, radio host of Speak Up and Stay Alive, Patient Safety Radio, with a new line of essential oils called Tiny Drops. Now you too can have access to these amazing natural health options. For example, you can use lavender to reduce stress, sweet orange to improve your mood, peppermint to improve focus and energy and alleviate those headaches. Tiny Drops, big results. Visit tinydropseo.com.
In your face, all over the place. We're online 24/7. 24/7. You're listening to the hottest.
SpeakUpAndStayAlive.com. That's SpeakUpAndStayAlive.com.
Don't stop.
Second opinions. Yes. When it comes to your health, I say, don't stop. Don't stop asking. Don't stop researching. Don't stop thinking. Don't stop believing. Let's talk about the word opinion. You know me. I'm a Latin fan. No, not talking about J-Lo or Ricky Martin. Latin, the language. The word opinion, from Latin opinion, means conjecture, fancy, belief, what one thinks. And from the stem of opinari, the Latin stem, think, judge, suppose. Notice, nowhere does it indicate the word fact. An opinion is not a hard fact. It is a view or judgment formed about something, not necessarily based on fact or knowledge, or the beliefs or views of a large number or majority of people about a particular thing. Many people, when told that they have cancer or another life-threatening illness, feel that they must make a decision right then and begin treatment that very same day. And while this may be true in some cases, Taking the time to learn about your disease, getting a second opinion, or perhaps even a third opinion, and weighing your options is a very reasonable approach. And you as the patient have every right to make informed decisions that, heck, ultimately affect your life. But many people fear their doctors, and they worry that the doctor might become upset if, when the question comes up about seeking a second opinion. I would think that most doctors would welcome another physician's input. Many people suggest that you ask your doctor to recommend someone to give you a second opinion. Personally, I wouldn't do that. I'd go completely outside of the practice, outside of the hospital system, and to go into this realizing that doctors' opinions may differ. According to the Patient Advocate Foundation, they say, a different doctor may come up with a different diagnosis, or at least offer a different opinion as to treatment choices. And not every doctor will have the same opinion with regard to diseases and possible treatments. Factors which may have an effect on a doctor's opinion are the technology available to that doctor, school of thought, where they were trained, individual methods of treatment and experience in dealing with that particular diagnosis. So it's clear that treatment methods may differ. Some doctors prefer to monitor the situation and use less aggressive procedures before moving to surgical interventions. Some doctors like to use more aggressive treatments from the beginning. But by getting a second opinion, you can expand your options about different treatment methods which may be most suitable for you and your situation. I say being informed is always your best option. Plus, if you hear the same diagnosis or treatment option from two or more doctors, you'll feel a bit more confident with your decision. And here's another not-so-nice idea. Because doctors are human, their decisions may be influenced by business, not just medicine. Now, I'm certainly not saying that a doctor would recommend something to harm you, but it's the law of the instrument, the law of the hammer, that says give a boy a hammer and everything looks like a nail. In other words, a surgeon might be more inclined to suggest surgery versus let's wait and see. Or perhaps when more than one treatment option has a similar rate of success, the doctor may make a recommendation that is better for his or her business and not necessarily better for you. I know about this. This happened to me a few years ago. Do you remember when I told you how I went kayaking a while back and how the stairs on the dock totally sheared off as I was climbing down, causing me to fall and have the stairs land on my foot? Well, I went to the urgent care. They x-rayed and wrapped the foot. A few weeks later, I went to a sports medicine doctor who helped somewhat. And then months later, as it was still hurting when I walked, I went to a foot specialist. This guy walked in, didn't wash his hands, took a look at my foot, mumbled some words I did not understand, I think they were in another language, and announced immediate surgery. He then walked out, no goodbyes, and sent his assistant in to make the arrangements. Oh, I myself said goodbye and never went back. And today, I'm walking just fine, no pains, no problems. As I look back, this doctor was all about surgery. He was a surgeon. That was his instrument, and my freshly painted pink toenails were just calling for a nice fine slice. Statistics show that over 1/3 of adults in the United States will never seek a second opinion, and almost 1/10 of newly diagnosed patients rarely or never understand their diagnoses. I'm going to guess it's a bigger number than that. Studies have shown that 30% of patients who sought second opinions for elective surgery found that the two opinions were not in agreement. These studies are one more reason why you need to make sure you are educated properly to make the best decision for your health. So when seeking a second opinion, what should you do? First, check with your insurance provider to determine coverage, especially if the visit is out of your network. Assuming it is medically necessary, most insurance plans will pay for at least part of the cost, while Medicare will pay 80% of the cost. And if the second opinion doesn't agree with the first, Medicare will pay 80% of the cost of a third opinion. Patients that belong to a Medicare HMO are entitled to a second opinion, but some plans require a referral from your primary care physician. And like most HMO treatments, you must seek an in-network physician. So there's a lot to know. To learn about second opinions, you can go to medicare.gov. They also have an 800 number, which is 800-MEDICARE. Also, be sure to check to see that the new specialist accepts your insurance type. Diagnostic tests can be very expensive, not to mention invasive, and if you're talking about x-rays and CAT scans, those subject you to high doses of radiation. and many insurance providers will not pay for them if they were completed for the initial diagnosis. So again, lots of reasons to have copies of the tests that you've already had done so you don't repeat them, both for financial purposes and for health-related purposes. Bring your medical records, including copies of all scans, exams, previous treatments, blood tests, and pathology slides with you to the appointment. Be clear what you're looking for from the second opinion. Do you need confirmation that your current treatment recommendation is correct for you? Or are you looking for other options? Are you interested in clinical trials? Alternative modalities? You know, sometimes there may not be time to get a second opinion. Getting a second opinion may delay treatment that you might need. So if you have a serious medical condition, you should take this into account when deciding to ask for a second opinion. Bottom line, remember, the root of the word, Latin, opinare, which means think, judge, suppose. And notice nowhere does it indicate the word fact. And given that a set of symptoms does not take into account you as a unique individual, an opinion simply cannot be a hard fact. It is a view or a judgment, not necessarily based on the knowledge of you, your mindset, your genetics, your will. As I said at the beginning, when it comes to your health, I say, don't stop. Don't stop asking. Don't stop researching. Don't stop thinking. And certainly, don't stop believing.
Want even more information? Purchase a copy of Pat's book at speakupandstayalive.com. Once again, it's speakupandstayalive.com. Or you can call Pat at 440-725-5462.
Hot. Bring the heat.
And now, your host, Pat Rulo.
You're listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive Patient Safety Radio, and I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. Are you ready for some news and views I choose to share with you? Well, if you are, here we go. Last week, I read about a sad situation that I'd like to share with you. At least 67 employees at a pharmaceutical company in Princeton, New Jersey, who received the flu vaccinations at their office, have been warned that they may have been exposed to infected blood and are being screened for HIV and hepatitis after a nurse was found reusing a syringe to administer flu shots. These patients have now been called in for testing, but face a long, anxious wait, as it can be months before serious infections such as HIV show up in blood work. The healthcare provider, Total Wellness, confirmed that the nurse contracted to carry out the flu shots had failed to follow proper medical procedures and safeguards. Jeez. The New Jersey Department of Health sent out letters to the 67 pharmaceutical co-workers 2 days after the vaccinations to warn them that the syringe was reused multiple times. And while the letter said that the risk of contamination was low, it urged those affected to seek testing for hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and HIV. The Department of Health said that the nurse had changed the needle between each injection but reused the same syringe each time. Therefore, patients must be retested in 4 to 6 months before they can be given a clean bill of health. And one employee said that having to wait so long for the results was giving her incredible anxiety. Well, I would say so. Can you imagine that? Officials investigating the incident also found that the nurse also gave less than the recommended dose of flu shot at the Mercer County Clinic. The Department of Health warned that anyone wanting to be protected against flu this winter would need to have another vaccination. This is very weird. This is not the first time a medical blunder has potentially put lives at risk. In 2014, more than 4,000 patients were warned that they could have been exposed to HIV and hepatitis at a New York hospital after insulin pens used to treat diabetes were reused on more than one person. The hospital said that 4,200 patients may have received insulin from the pens, not a single-use disposable needle that could have been used on more than one patient from as far back as 2011. Now, according to the CDC website, and frankly, just plain common sense, patients need to be aware of a very serious threat to their health, and that is the reuse of needles or syringes and the misuse of medication vials. Healthcare providers, and actually anyone providing injections, should never reuse a needle or a syringe, either from one patient to another or to withdraw medicine from a vial. Both the needle and the syringe must be discarded once they have been used. It is not safe to change the needle and reuse the syringe, as this practice can transmit disease. A single-use vial is a bottle of liquid medication that is given to a patient through a needle and syringe. Single-use vials contain only one dose of medication and should only be used once for one patient, using a clean needle and a clean syringe. A multi-dose vial is a bottle of liquid medication that contains more than one dose of medication and is often used by diabetic patients or for vaccinations. A new clean needle and clean syringe should always be used to access that medication in a multi-dose vial. Reuse of needles or syringes to access medication can result in contamination of the medicine with germs that therefore can be spread to others when the medicine is used again. Wow. And with all the excitement of the government to vaccinate everything and everybody at every opportunity, even against low-risk possibilities, you find all of these pop-up flu shot kiosks with who knows who doing the injecting of who knows what. Waiting for your next flight at the airport? Grab some peanuts and a flu shot. Oh yeah, that sounds safe. But yep, this is true. After taking off your shoes and pulling out change from your pockets and going through security checkpoints, with a little x-ray, passengers now can roll up their sleeves and get a flu shot at gateside kiosks and health stations in many major U.S. airports. And the vaccine mill continues. The pharmacy, the grocery store, at work, at school, there are even drive-through flu shots. Wind down your window, stick out your arm, and off you go. Where's the post office in all of this? Missing some revenue, I'd say. Or what about gas stations, banks, restaurants? Come on, people, get with the program. Heck, it's easy. All you need is one syringe. Change the needle every now and then if you feel like it, and jab away. Personally, I wouldn't use any of these places. And if I did get a flu shot, which I'm not, but if I did, I would ask my doctor to give me the pamphlet, the actual insert that comes with the injection, to read about the ingredients. I'd also ask the following questions and watch to see that they opened a fresh single-use vial and prepared a new and fresh syringe and needle. Ask, with these words actually coming out of your mouth, will there be a new needle, a new syringe, and a new vial for this procedure or injection? Can you tell me how you prevent the spread of infections in your facility? And three, what steps are you taking to keep me safe? It's not weird or rude to insist upon basic common sense. You won't get the flu, but you might contract HIV or hepatitis. Not a trade-off, if you ask me. And speaking of drugs, here's another unreal story. Drugs that mimic the benefits of exercise could soon become a reality thanks to some breakthrough research from the University of Sydney's Charles Perkins Center. Exercise is the most powerful therapy for many human diseases, including type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and neurological disorders. However, for many people, exercise isn't a viable treatment option. This means it is essential that we find ways of developing drugs that mimic the benefits of exercise. The University of Sydney researchers, in collaboration with the researchers from the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, analyzed human skeletal muscle biopsies from four untrained, healthy males following 10 minutes of high-intensity exercise. And they discovered that short, intensive exercise triggers more than 1,000 changes. While scientists have long suspected that exercise causes a complicated series of changes to human muscle, this is the first time we have been able to map exactly what happens. They say this is a major breakthrough as it allows scientists to use this information to design a drug that mimics the true beneficial changes caused by exercise. And I say, hello, side effects. Oh, wow. That's right, folks. Eat all you want. Plenty of genetically modified food. Don't bother exercising. And take a drug that mimics exercise. Wow. I don't know about you, but I can't take any more of these news and views. So let's say adieu. Well, there you have it. Another jam-packed show just for you. And if you want more, buy a copy of my book, Speak Up and Stay Alive, The Patient Advocate Hospital Survival Guide. It will keep you safe during any healthcare or hospital encounter. Just visit the website, speakupandstayalive.com, speakupandstayalive.com, and invite me to speak to your group, your club, business, church, school, or hospital. Call me, and let's talk about how we can make your next event a winner. 440-725-5462. That's 440-725-5462. And come back next week. Same time, same place, but never the same information. Until then, I hope you have a healthy and a happy week, free from confusing hospital status and contaminated syringes. I am Pat Rulo, and I am your guide to safe and successful healthcare and hospital encounters.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.